This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
Thank you, barakatuh. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala nabiyil kareem wa ala alihi wa ashabi ajma'in. Once again, welcome and thank you all for attending. This week's lesson is something which I believe is very, very important for our community. And specifically from all the lessons we're going to discuss, I think this week's lesson is a thing that I really would love to teach our youth and our teenagers and our preteens. I believe that this concept that we're going to study today, if people learn this concept when they are 11 or 12 years old, they will be able to protect themselves from a lot of major sins in their teenage years and their early 20s. So it's a very, very crucial concept that we're going to study today. So, inshallah, I hope that you will find this beneficial and be able to take this information to the next generation in some form or the other, whether it's discussions with your family, whether it's getting people to listen to this online or to watch the recording on YouTube, whatever it is, just to get this information to the right people. Right, so before we get into today's actual topic, which is the attainment of benefit and the removal of harm as the primary goal of the Sharia, just a brief recap of what we covered last week. Last week we did our basic definition. Maqasid al-Sharia means the goals or the objectives of Islamic law. Why did Allah reveal laws? That's simply what this topic is all about. This subject is about why. Right? All of us study the law. That's something we all learn in madrasa, we learn in Islamic school, we all study the law. One thing that many of us may not have studied is why. Right? And we said, this whole concept is derived from the name of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Al-Hakim, the one with infinite wisdom. If Allah's wisdom is infinite, this means that every law He has revealed is based on divine wisdom. And so maqasid is simply a ijtihadi effort to understand that wisdom. It is a reading of the Quran and Sunnah in a way in which we are able to derive that wisdom and figure out some of that wisdom. Not all of it, but some of it, whatever is within our capacity. We also learned, I mentioned it briefly, but this is the topic of today's lesson, that the primary goal of the Sharia is the attainment of benefit and the prevention of harm. What does that mean? Today's entire hour will focus on what that means. And we broke down benefit, or the other way of looking at maqasid al-Sharia, into the protection of five necessities called the dururiyat, right? The five necessities: religion, life, intellect, wealth, and number five goes by different names: lineage, honor, or family, right? And one very important point, not all of the Sharia is rational, meaning not all of the Sharia is such that we can understand why. It doesn't mean there's no wisdom, it means not everything we can understand why. There is a small part of it that is ta'abbudi. Ta'abbudi means you simply doing it out of obedience to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, without understanding why. We gave the example, we cannot figure out why we pray three rakats of Maghrib instead of two or four. We simply do it because Allah told us to do it. Right? So a small portion of the Sharia fits to that category. We don't understand why, but sami'na wa ata'na. We hear and we obey. Right? So there is a portion of the Sharia that is like that. So it's very important that we understand that. So this is basically a summary of last week. And what we're going to focus on this week is point number three. And point number three, I take it from the book by Ibn Ashur, rahimahullah, who we spoke about last week. He was the great Maliki scholar who revived the field of maqasid in the 20th century. In his book on maqasid al-Sharia, in one of his early chapters in that book, entitled The Primary Goal of the Sharia, he ends the chapter by saying, the entirety of the Sharia revolves around two things: the attainment of maslaha and the removal of mafsada. The attainment of benefit and the removal of harm. And so this statement summarizes what Islamic law is all about. Now, what does this mean on a practical level? How do we break it down? What is maslaha? What is mafsada? That's what we're going to get into today. But just a brief introduction to what do we mean by this statement. What we mean by this statement is, any command that Allah has revealed, Allah has commanded it because it's beneficial to us. And anything that Allah has made haram, He has made it haram because it is harmful to us. That's simply what the statement means. So, you can look at any of the obligations or the mustahab acts recommended in Islam, and you can derive from it some benefit. You can see, okay, there is benefit in doing this. There is benefit in praying 5 times a day. There is benefit in fasting the month of Ramadan. There is benefit in giving charity. There is benefit in getting married. There is benefit in studying. There is benefit in running a business. There is benefit in even in things that sometimes you may not think there is benefit. Jihad, for example, we mentioned that as well. Right? That in anything that Allah has legislated or allowed, there is some maslaha in it. There is some benefit in it. And whatever Allah has prohibited, whatever Allah has made haram, it is because of the existence of mafsada, harm. That these elements are harmful to society. Alcohol, gambling, zina, shirk, all of these things are harmful to society. Some of them are harmful spiritually. Some of them are harmful physically. Some of them are harmful emotionally. But all of them have some kind of harm. And so, when you study the Sharia, when you look at laws, you should look at it from this perspective. If Allah has commanded it, there must be benefit in it. If Allah has prohibited it, it must be harmful. What maqasid is all about is figuring out what those benefits are, and what those harms are, and then using that also for ijtihad on secondary issues. So to begin, let's look at the first half, which is maslaha. What is maslaha? And you will hear this topic quite often in modern day discussions of fiqh, right? Even in its plural form, masalih. You hear people talking about weighing the masali and the mafasid, weighing the benefits and the harms. Because this is a modern method of fiqh based on maqasid al-sharia. That when you're looking at something new and you're trying to figure out is it halal or haram, you're going to look at the benefits and the harms and you're going to weigh it on a scale. Because the reality is most of the things that exist in the world today are not 100% beneficial or 100% harmful. They are a mixture of both. Right? So life comes down to measuring masali and mafasid. So what is maslaha? Maslaha, which comes from the root word salaha, which means to be good, to be righteous, to be beneficial. All of these meanings can be taken from it. Right? So the word salih, pious person, comes from the same root. Islah, to reform society, comes from the same root. Maslaha means, according to Ash-Shatibi, that which produces benefit to people at a collective and individual level. So Ash-Shatibi was one of the classical Maliki scholars who wrote about Maqasid al-Sharia. And in his book, he defined maslaha as that which is beneficial for people at a collective and individual level. So immediately, we break down maslaha into two categories. Amma and khasa. Public maslaha and individual maslaha. What do we mean by public maslaha and individual maslaha? We mean by this that the Sharia is such that all of the laws of the Sharia have individual benefits and benefits for society as a whole. Some of them focus on individual benefits, some on the societal level, and some on both. So an example of both is zakah. When we give zakah, the individual maslaha there is purifying our souls from miserliness and greed. So that's a maslaha khasa. That's something that benefits you. The maslaha amma of giving zakah is that money circulates not only amongst the rich, but it reaches other people as well. So when someone discharges their zakah, there is benefit for the individual and benefit for the public in one act of worship. Right? Now some acts of worship will have public benefit. Some will have individual benefit. Some will have both. And sometimes there'll be a clash. Sometimes you have to choose between a public benefit and a individual benefit. In these cases, the maxim is, in most cases, obviously there's exceptions, but in most cases, public benefit takes precedence over individual benefit. Meaning, if something is going to benefit you, but it's going to harm the public, or it's going to cause problems for other people, then the other people are given preference over yourself in most cases. The classical example mentioned in the book of fiqh is if you have a house right next door to your neighbor and if you're going, if building a wall in your property is going to obstruct his property in some way, so for example, maybe block his view or block the sunlight from getting into his garden or something like that, the government can actually, in an Islamic country, prevent you from building a wall in your own property because of the harm it will cause to your neighbor. Or because it will prevent him from some benefit. Maybe sunlight's not going to reach his garden or something like that. So you need his permission to build a wall. Right? So it's not always a matter of, you know, this is where Islam comes very different from modern Western philosophy. Modern Western philosophy is all about my rights, my wants, what I want. Right? In Islam, it's all about the ummah, the society, you know, benefiting others. And so sometimes we sacrifice our individual rights, our individual wants, for the sake of the benefit of the ummah, our neighbors, our families, our friends, and other people. So we'll discuss that a bit more in the examples. The main point about this in fiqh is that the commandments and the prohibitions in our sharia, they revolve around the attainment of benefits. Meaning, you can look at anything that is wajib or mustahab in our sharia, and you can see the benefit in it. There is always benefit in it. So for example, what would be the benefit of salah? Can someone tell me what's the benefit of praying salah? If your child walks up to you and says, why should I pray salah? And if you tell them, because Allah commanded you, they'll say, yeah, but what's in it for me? That's how people think these days. What's in it for me? So why do you pray salah? Yes, that's one of the maqasid mentioned directly in the Quran. That salah prevents you from immorality. Someone who prays five times a day is less likely to commit major sins. Right? It prevents you from immorality. This is a benefit to you. It becomes a barrier between you and immorality. It also becomes a barrier between you and kufr. Right? The Prophet Muhammad stated about salah, فَمَنْ تَرَكَهُ فَقَدْ كَفَرَ. Whoever abandons it leaves the faith. There's two interpretations here. According to the Maliki, Shafi, and Hanbali madhab, it means if you don't pray five times a day, you're not a Muslim. According to the Hanafi madhab, it means if you don't pray five times a day, you are on a slippery slope. It's the first step towards kufr. Right? So there's a difference in interpretation. The other three madhabs take it to mean that it is kufr not to pray your salah. Just the act of not praying salah is an act of kufr, especially according to the Hanbali madhab, which is strictest on this issue. The Hanafi madhab takes a more relaxed interpretation of this hadith and says that the hadith means once you stop praying salah, you are opening the doors to kufr. You are heading down that path. Right? And so it's a very dangerous thing. So any act of worship, if you sit and think about it, this is what the scholars of Maqasid did. Right? The earliest known writing we have of this is Imam Ghazali's Ihya Ulumuddin. There may be some before that I'm not aware of, but that's the earliest known one that I've read. This is basically why the Ihya Ulumuddin is considered such a revolutionary work. Up until that point in our history, nobody ever actually sat down and wrote about why. Right, so he wrote about why we pray salah, why we fast, why we give zakah, what's the benefits of all of these things, what's the harms caused by alcohol and drugs and all drugs, what, you know, whatever was available in those times, all these things that existed in his time. He wrote about the benefits and the harms, and this was the first time that Islam was actually taught, you know, in this manner, in such a wide level. And that's why right to today, the book by Al-Ghazali is considered one of the most beneficial and defining books in our history. So, give examples of this. I have some on the next page. But just to clarify, when we talk about benefits, again, many a times we only think of benefits physically because we've been trained through that, to a consumer culture. Everything's about physical or monetary benefits, right? But the Sharia talks about benefits. It also talks about spiritual benefits. So sometimes something doesn't have a physical benefit, it has a spiritual benefit. Like fasting's benefit is لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ, so that your taqwa increases. This is a spiritual benefit. Right? It's not something physical. But there are things which have physical benefits as well in our Sharia. Fasting also has physical benefits. That's something that's very clear from modern science. Emotional benefits. So the laws of Islam have emotional benefits. The clearest example is marriage. What did Allah say about marriage in the Quran? He says that it puts between your hearts love and mercy. Right? Love and mercy. It puts this between people's hearts. This is an emotional benefit of obeying Allah. He puts this in people's hearts when they get married the right way. Then monetary benefits. right? There are monetary benefits to following the Sharia when it comes to business, when it comes to zakah, when it comes to these things. Sometimes the monetary benefits are not for you, sometimes it's for the poor, sometimes it's for the community. But there are monetary benefits to following the Sharia as well. So just a few examples of how the ulama have looked at different parts of the Sharia and mentioned their maslaha. Salah. So the ulama have derived multiple benefits of praying five times a day. The primary and most important one is to preserve our faith. Right, so last week we said the entire Sharia revolves primarily around preserving five things. Number one is our faith. Number two is our lives, our intellect, our wealth, and our family. So number one is our faith. And therefore, when you look at the pillars of Islam, Shahada, our faith. Salah, our faith. Fasting, our faith. Right? Zakah and Hajj, that goes into the other elements. Preserving wealth, preserving society, you know, but also faith involved as well. All five have faith involved. Right? Because all five work to preserve your faith. But salah primarily, as I mentioned the hadith, for man tarakahu faqad kafara, whoever abandons it begins to leave the faith, or leaves the faith depending which interpretation you follow, is directly linked to our faith. Another benefit mentioned in the Quran for salah is it makes you remember Allah. Right? The salah makes you remember Allah. So people who pray five times a day are more conscious of Allah. They think about Allah more often. And so this again has a third benefit, which is what was mentioned earlier. Inna salata tanha anil fahshai wal munkar. Right? The salah prevents you from immorality and indecency, major sins. Right? So these are benefits for salah. And really, if somebody had to ask, why should I pray five times a day? The primary reason is praying five times a day keeps you Muslim. Right? There's this concept in Islam of our iman, our taqwa going up and down. Our iman, it goes up and it goes down. I think everyone's experienced that. You have days where you feel pious and you have days where you're like on the verge of committing major sins. Right? Our iman is always going up and down. How do we maintain at least a moderate level of iman throughout the year? Praying five times a day. Right? You'll notice the day you stop praying five times a day, your iman drops like that. So this is to preserve our faith. It keeps us there. Now how do you increase your iman? You pray the sunnah, you pray the tahajjud, you add upon it, you build upon it. But for preservation's sake, the five salah are there. So the five salah is not a luxury. It's not something that only pious people do. It's literally the minimum every believer has to do just to maintain their faith. Point number two. And I mentioned this already. Zakah is an obligation. There are multiple benefits from zakah. For us, it purifies our soul. It gets rid of our greed. It gets rid of our miserliness. But more importantly, the Quran mentions about financial transactions of this nature, that one of the maqasid mentioned in the Quran is so that wealth does not only circulate amongst the rich. This is one of the verses of the Quran, the translation of it. So that wealth does not circulate only amongst the rich. When we are giving zakah, when we are giving sadaqah, when we have a waqf set up, when we are doing all of these different things, then we make sure that even if we are getting richer, we are taking the rest of society with us. We're not leaving people behind. Everybody benefits. So when a Muslim becomes a billionaire and he's giving his zakah, he's creating multiple millionaires in the process. Right? So there's the circulation of wealth. So this is something that's a public benefit of zakah, that it helps people. And really, when zakah is applied properly at a government level, in a country that's doing well financially, it can alleviate poverty completely. It can work to completely alleviate poverty, because if all the billionaires in the world are paying 2.5% zakah, then everybody will have enough money to meet their basic needs. No one's going to be below the poverty line. There is that much money in the world. It's just that with capitalism, there is no obligation to give charity. Right? It's there, but it's not an obligation. Now with our Sharia, it's an obligation for this specific reason. Another example of maslaha, and this is where maslaha clashes with another maslaha, jihad. So people always wonder, why does Islam allow jihad? Now obviously in the time and place that we live in South Africa, there is no jihad. Right, so we don't talk about it in that way. But just as an example of maslaha, people wonder why. Why would Islam allow warfare? It allows war because the greater maslaha takes precedence over the individual maslaha. Protecting the state, protecting the citizens, protecting the ummah, protecting the religion, all of this takes precedence over protecting the individual lives of the soldiers. So a Muslim man may go out and fight to defend his country, to defend his religion, to defend his family. He is risking his life to protect others. Right? This is the example where public maslaha takes precedence over individual maslaha. And a man is putting his life on the line to protect his country or to protect his religion. Right? So jihad falls into that category. Education, we know our religion has made seeking knowledge an obligation. Right? Seeking knowledge is an obligation in our religion. And even though that refers primarily to Islamic knowledge, it encompasses anything you need to do to live a life of ihsan, to live a life of excellence. Anything you need to live a life of excellence will fall into this category, right? That a Muslim should seek out the best education possible in whatever field they are in. They should seek to be the best in their field. So why did Islam place so much priority on education? Because again, this is a maslaha amma. This is a public benefit. When a Muslim is well educated, whether it's in the religion, whether it's in medicine, whether it's in business, whether it's in accounting, counseling, whatever it is, it doesn't just benefit the individual, it benefits the entire community. Everybody benefits, right? So for the sake of public benefit, making sure that the community has people who are well skilled at everything, we have a lot of emphasis on education. And this is one of the problems with many of the modern jihadist movements. They focus only on Islamic education. And that's a very poor form of Islamic education. So when they do finally form their so-called Islamic states, it collapses very quickly. Why? There's no doctors, there's no politicians, there's no public servants, there's no one who knows accounting, there's no one who knows how to manage the finances of the country, how to run a country, how to administer a country. They have nothing. They literally just have soldiers. You can't run a country on just soldiers. Right? So our religion teaches a comprehensive education system. It's not just focused on one thing. Marriage. We'll come to this specifically when we do preservation of family. But it's very important nowadays. You know, until a generation ago, nobody questioned the concept of marriage. We now have people questioning the very idea of marriage. Right? In fourth wave feminism, they question marriage completely. They say this is a concept from the patriarchy. It's a way of men of controlling women. Right? In this modern age of zina, people think, why should I get married? If everything's freely available, what's the point? What's the benefit? What am I getting out of this? Right? And with the spread of divorce that we are seeing in our community, a lot of young people are growing up. They're seeing divorce all around them. They're seeing people fighting all around them. They see other people enjoying lives of zina. They ask, why should I get married? What's the point of marriage? And so we now have people who have no intention to ever get married their entire lives. We actually have this happening today. So it's very important that at a young age, you discuss with your teenagers, or even before they become teenagers, the importance of marriage in Islam and the benefits in it. Because marriage doesn't just have benefits for the individual. That's more or less what we focus on. There's benefits for the entire family. There's benefits for the husband, the wife, the children, the parents, the grandparents, the grandchildren that will come from it. For everybody involved, there is a comprehensive set of maslaha, of benefits that come when people work towards having happy marriages. And I'm going to discuss this in details later on, when I come to the zina slide. I'm going to compare the two, but I'll discuss it in even more details in a later week when we discuss the preservation of family. Just for now, it's important for young people to understand this. If someone asks you, why should I get married, what's the point? Right? To be able to show them the benefits of marriage. And you know why we can't show them the benefits of marriage today? Because as a society, we become very negative towards it. Divorce is higher than it's ever been in our history. Right? People only talk bad about it. If you look at the jokes we make about marriage, what do people say? The most expensive pair of handcuffs. Right? Things like that. Now, we make that jokingly, but do you ever think the psychological impact that has on the younger people that's listening? Why would they want a pair of handcuffs? Why would they want to be chained to someone? Right? And these are the jokes we make. We say the old ball and chain and things like that. You know, we make marriage sound like such a prison sentence. And then we wonder why young people are scared of getting married. So as a society, our whole attitude towards this topic has to change. And really, parents have to demonstrate this to their children. Parents have to demonstrate to their children that their marriage has made them happy. Their marriage has brought benefits into their life. Their marriage has brought peace into their life. Parents have to show this. A lot of times we don't, you know, I think in our Indian culture we have this, that we don't express emotion in front of our children. Especially when it comes to marital emotion. So the only time they ever see their parents expressing emotion is when they're shouting at each other. So that's it. Marriage is two people living together and shouting at each other. Why would they want that? So it's very important not just to discuss this, but to model this. We need to model this for our children, that marriage is something beautiful, and it's something that they must work for, and something they should want for and aspire for in life. Right. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran says that Allah has made business halal for you. And so in this, Allah has created, has allowed a system that benefits all of society. Really, when Muslims engage in business in a way that is halal, in a way that is ethical, in a way that's free of corruption and bribery and exploitation of their workers, when all the Sharia requirements are met, it benefits everybody. Right? It benefits the customer, it benefits the businessman, it benefits the employees, it benefits the people after that. We know economies have an effect, an after effect. One person, whatever they do, affects the next person. So, when business is done properly the Islamic way, everybody benefits. Now, we're living in a country which has a lot of unemployment, a lot of poverty, a lot of exploitation, and sadly, the average Muslim businessman hasn't really modeled this system. If we model the system, we can help so many people. Now, just setting up a good business, just the amount of people you apply, you give employment to, how many people you save from poverty like that? You know, we don't think of it that way. We think of business only in terms of I'm making money, right? But really, a Muslim should think of business as benefiting society, giving people jobs, helping people's families out. It's all about the ummah. It's not just about you. So this is another perspective to look at business from. That it's not about me. It's about benefiting others. And really the best businesses are those that benefit others. That's where all the best businesses start. They start from focusing on others, not on yourself. So that's maslaha. So, for the second half today, we look at the opposite end. What's the opposite end? Mafsada. What's mafsada? Harm. It's a synonym for darar. Right? So in Qawaidul Fiqhiyah, we call it darar. In Maqasid al-Sharia, we call it mafsada. Harm. Other translations of mafsada, evil, corruption, sin, immorality. These are all ways of translating the word mafsada. So Islam prohibits all forms of mafsada. Right? There's a beautiful verse in the Quran. I can't remember the full verse right now, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that who is it that's making haram the beautiful things of this world that Allah has created for His servants? Allah says, say to them, Allah has only prohibited that which is immoral and that which is harmful, and there's a list of about 5 or 6 things in that verse. Again, I don't have the full verse coming to mind right now. But the verse is very beautiful because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is saying in this verse that who is making everything haram? Allah didn't make everything haram. Allah only made harmful things haram. Right? So why are people making things haram which Allah did not make haram? And really this becomes our principle. When someone tells you this is haram, I always ask why. If it's mentioned in the Quran or Hadith, yes, sami'na wa ata'na. If it's not mentioned in the Quran or Hadith, they need to show us what's harmful about it. Right? And this is why, you know, many times when people come up to you saying, for example, the Etoro TV series, right? On Netflix, people are like, it's haram. It's a TV show, it's got music, it's got women. Like, yeah, but if you weigh the masali and the mafasid, I mean, people watch this and watch all that other stuff, right? But then people today is like haram, just flat out haram. Again, it comes down to weighing the benefits and harms. Is there actually harm in watching that? Right? Compared to everything else. So, mafsada refers to harm. Allah has only prohibited that which is harmful, that which is corrupting to society. And really, this is the definition of mafsada. Anything that corrupts society or causes harm either to an individual or to society. And this is where a lot of the young people don't understand about Islam. People always ask, what's the harm in it? Right? Because when they think of harm, what they are thinking about? Individual harm. They're not thinking about societal harm. So, the classic example is zina. Right? Young people today say, what's the harm in it? Just two people doing something they enjoy together. That's the way they look at it. So they don't look at the societal harms, they only look at the individual pleasures. our religion teaches us to focus on the broader picture. That sometimes something may seem nice to an individual, but its effects on society are devastating. Right? The effects it has on society as a whole are devastating. And so, one of the first things we have to teach people is don't just think about yourself. Think about the broader implications of this culture and how it affects all of society. Then you begin to see the actual harms. And so, when we talk about harm, we're not just talking about harm to you. Harm to anybody. If what you want to do in any way harms anyone else, right? Even if it's emotionally, even if it's spiritually, then as a Muslim, you have to think twice about doing it. So, what's the harm in it? Well, we have to look at all these other things, and we'll discuss that in the next slide, examples of the harm. So, our Sharia was revealed to minimize and prevent harm so that humans can live in peace and safety. Ideally, in a proper Islamic country, Muslims and citizens, even the non-Muslim citizens, will feel safe. They will feel safe because harm is minimized. Notice, I did not say harm is eliminated. I said harm is minimized. Why? Because the elimination of harm completely from society is an unrealistic ideal. It's not possible. It's impossible to have a society where nobody steals, nobody murders, nobody does evil. There will always be one or two individuals doing something. Right? But that's a huge step up from where we are today. Right? So what Islam does, it creates a system that minimizes the harm. So while we live in a society where murders take place every day, in a proper Islamic environment, it may be once every 10 years. And it shocks the entire community. Right? Because the way our Sharia is designed is to minimize harm in society. But the Sharia also recognizes it's impossible to get rid of harm altogether. So some forms of harm are permissible. They are permissible when there is a greater benefit in it. And that takes us to two of the maxims that govern this concept. Right? Number one, sometimes a small harm is tolerated to prevent a greater harm. Sometimes a small harm is tolerated to prevent a greater harm. What's this concept called in English? The lesser of two evils. Right? The lesser of two evils. In our Sharia, it's called the lesser of two harms. Right? The maxim is, when there are two conflicting harms, choose the lesser of two harms. Right? And this is a principle of our religion. That in life, to be realistic, you are going to face situations where there is no win. Either way, someone's getting hurt. What do you do in those situations? You choose the least harmful option. Right? You choose the least harmful option. So, for example, okay, the example I'll come to on the next page. But just to give you a general example of that, would be, you know, divorce. I was going to leave it for the next page, but just example. The concept of divorce. Why does Islam allow it? Because there is harm that takes place, especially if there's children involved. It's only allowed because it prevents a greater harm. If we had to do what the Catholic Church did and made it completely haram, can you imagine what happens if someone ends up in the wrong marriage, an abusive marriage or something, and there is no way out? Now imagine the level of harm that causes to society. And so the harms that come with the divorce are tolerated because they prevent a greater harm. The other example of that, the one I was supposed to mention, it slipped my mind, was jihad. Again, there is harm that's caused. People are dying, people are killing each other. Right? But it's allowed to prevent a greater harm. What's the greater harm? The Muslim being overrun and exterminated. Right? So it's allowed to prevent a greater harm. Sometimes the individual harm is tolerated to prevent a public harm. The classical examples of this are our punishments for criminal law. Right? So individual harm, amputating the hand of a thief, executing a murderer. These are individual harms. There is obvious harm happening to an individual here. Why does our Sharia tolerate it or allow it? Because it prevents a public harm. It prevents murder and stealing from becoming rampant in society. So we rather see one murderer executed than 100 innocent people killed. Right? So this is, again, an individual harm is tolerated. Why? Because it prevents a public harm. Examples of this. And this is the main example why I want that we need to focus on today. The spread of zina. The spread of zina is a form of harm that threatens the preservation of honor and lineage. You know, this is actually something that needs to be taught in Islamic sex education to 11 and 12 year olds. You need to start at that age. Because what they're going to ask you as teenagers is, what's the harm in having a girlfriend? What's wrong with it? So from the time you first teach them about this subject, you have to emphasize the maslaha of marriage and the mafsada of zina. That needs to be driven home. That yes, the two acts are the same, but one leads to benefits for society and the other leads to harm in society. So can someone give me an example? What's the mafsada that comes with this? One example, there's lots of ideas. There's lots of harms. Just one example. We live in a zina culture. And to be frank, we live in zina culture. That's our country, that's our society. It's a zina culture. We see it all around us. What harms have you seen arising from this? Okay, first in the STDs. That's number one. What else? It's directly linked to the rise of divorce rates. It is directly linked. People feel they now have more free access to do what they want. There's more temptation. It's easier to fall into adultery. It's easier for marriages to be broken. And then what does that lead to? Broken homes. What do broken homes lead to? Children growing up without a father or without a mother. Right? What does that lead to? Crime. Drug addiction. You see how one thing's leading to another. And it's all directly linked to zina. It's all directly linked to zina. You can find ways to show children. And for teenagers, you can focus on something even more personal to them. You know, people who wait until marriage will not go through heartbreak and all of the things related to that as teenagers. Because some of the most difficult things teenagers go through is getting a girlfriend or boyfriend, breaking up, the heartbreak that follows, the humiliation that follows, the name-calling that follows, the shaming that follows, sometimes the pregnancy may come from that, sometimes the STD may come from that, sometimes whatever comes from that affects you for the rest of your life. To actually sit down with a 12 or 13-year-old and explain all of this to them drives home the point of why they must stay away from zina. It's not just a matter of, someone was telling me today that her mother never had the talk with her. I said, well, what did your mother do? She simply told me, don't talk to boys. And that didn't work. And, you know, that's the problem we have. You know, we don't talk about these things. I mean, just telling someone, don't talk to boys or don't talk to girls, that's a very impractical thing to say, because the reality is, if they're going to school, if they go to university, if they get a job, they just go to the supermarket. You are going to interact with the opposite gender. Right? What I rather teach is how to be a gentleman, how to lower your gaze, how to interact with the opposite gender with respect. Right? These type of things should be taught instead of just don't talk to boys or don't talk to girls. But the fact that parents aren't even having this talk with their children at all, and then they wonder, you know, let's put it in the child's mind, okay? Let's put this into context. In the olden days, by olden days I mean right until just 100 years ago, when a child hits puberty, they used to get married. This is a fact of life. This is a fact of life, not in Muslim society, in every society. Right? What age did Gandhi get married? Who knows? 11. Gandhi got married when he was 11. How long ago was that? One generation ago. Literally, I mean, when you guys were young, he passed away, right? For you all, it's literally one generation before you. So this is not something ancient. This is just, this past 100 years in history have been the only point in time in history where people don't get married when they hit puberty. Right? Instead, in the 1950s, marketing agencies in America, wanting to sell more things, came up with a new concept called teenagers. This word never existed before. What's a teenager? Physically an adult, mentally a child. So now our children go through a new phase. From puberty until 18 or 20, they are physically adults, they are Islamically adults, but they are in society children, going to school, but treated as children by their parents, but they have the sexual desires of adults, and they are watching Netflix, they are watching TV, they are seeing sex everywhere. Let's be frank, that's the only thing they're seeing on TV. What do you think goes through their minds? How do they deal with this? What's the solution here? Right? Because let's, you know, our society, what age do we expect our children to get married? between 25 and 30. If someone hits puberty when they're 13, and the father only expects him to get married when he's 27, what do you think is going to happen for that period? From 13 to 27? Something bad is going to happen. Right? That's just being realistic. So, firstly, with our children, we have to sit down and have the talk. Explain to them the maslaha of marriage. Explain to them the mafsada of zina. Explain to them the importance of waiting until marriage. With boys and girls, with both. Then, as parents also, we have to be realistic and find a way to meet them halfway. So, in lots of families I know, who are more concerned about this topic, when their children are around the ages of 18 to 20, they have a nikah performed between them and someone they like. And they may not move in together straight away, but the nikah is done. Right? So that pressure is gone and that halal is there. So for example, you have an 18-year-old who's going to university. Maybe she wants to become a psychiatrist. And there's another practicing Muslim boy also going to university, wants to become a psychiatrist. And they both like each other. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the parents having the nikah performed between them. And so they both carry on going to university, studying. After they graduate, they're moving together 5 or 6 years later. But during that period, they have someone halal in their lives. We have to start thinking like new ideas. Because the idea of expecting them just to wait that whole period, you're not giving them a solution. There has to be some kind of solution. There has to be some middle part where parents and children have to meet. And specifically, if you're a parent of a child of a young man or woman in that age, if your son and daughter is telling you, "I need to get married," and you're telling them when you finish your studies, understand something. Your son or daughter is not going to tell you, "I need to get married," unless what? Why would they ever bring that topic up with their parents? They need to get married. It's the most awkward thing to tell your parents. They're only going to say that when it's like overpowering now. If it doesn't happen now, zina is going to happen. So parents need to take that seriously when the child says that. So getting back to what I was saying about this topic, when you sit down to talk to your child about this, and as a teacher, when you teach children in school about this, it must come from a maslaha and mafsada perspective. You must sit your child down and tell them, Allah created Adam alayhi salam, and He created Hawa alayhi salam to be His spouse. Why did Allah do this? Because men and women are meant to get married. This is our nature, right? This is how the human race survives. This is how we don't go extinct. Right? You have to explain all of this to them, the benefits of marriage. Allah says it creates love, it creates mercy. Children come from this. It leads to a dignified life. It leads to being respected in society. All of these things, the maslahas of marriage must be mentioned. So from a young age, they know, okay, I'm going to hit puberty, 5 or 6 or 8 years after, I'm going to get married. And during that period, I'm going to stay away from zina. Right? And to assist the staying away from zina part, we talk about the mafsada. We talk about the STDs. We talk about the unwanted pregnancies. We talk about the dishonor. We talk about the shame. We talk about what happens when people find out. Because even though we live in a culture where it's normal, people still shame each other over these things. We hear so many stories happening where someone slipped up one day and someone made a video of it and sent it via WhatsApp to all that person's friends and family, and for the rest of their life their name is tarnished. These kind of things, we have to discuss it, because this is the only thing that's going to stop them. Right? They live in a culture where this is normal, and it's promoted as something good, and we have to explain why it's evil and why there's mafsada in it. So I went a bit long on that topic because that's really the big one, the important one to me. But there are other things, riba. Allah says He made business halal and riba haram. Why? Because the modern banking system is a mafsada to the economy. It causes harm. Poor people, poor countries take loans and then they can't pay back the loans plus interest. And what happens? Their poverty is just multiplied multiple times over. Why do you think we have load shedding? It's riba. Let's be frank, it's riba is linked to it, because if you look at the amount of money Eskom is owing plus interest, even with our high electricity fees, they still can't pay it off with the interest, because the interest levels are at that level. And this is, every African country is dealing with something like this. Every country on this continent is dealing with some kind of riba debt over them, keeping the country poor. It's not just individuals, it's whole countries, whole economies. On the individual level, it's even worse. People literally are slaves to banks today. We think slavery is over, but everyone's a slave to the bank. Whether it's your credit card, whether it's your mortgage, whatever it is, people are terrified of losing their job because, you know, what happens if they lose their job and they can't meet their payments? So riba is a corruption to the economy and an injustice to the poor. Drugs. Drugs are prohibited because of the harm they cause to both the individual and their families. Alcohol is in the same category. This doesn't need explanation. All of us have seen the harm that these things cause to people. Right? And an example of the opposite, which I already discussed. Divorce is a type of mafsada that we allow because prohibiting it would lead to a greater mafsada. Right? And we don't have to look far for examples of that. The Roman Catholic Church is a perfect example of the greater mafsada's cause by prohibiting divorce, right? I mean, kings had to invent entirely new churches to deal with it. It was the only way out. But this is really how our Sharia is practical. That sometimes, yes, something is harmful, but it's allowed because something even more harmful will happen if you don't allow it. So, why do we learn this? What's the importance of knowing about maslaha and mafsada? I'm going to begin with the hadith. قال رسول الله صلى الله عليه وسلم خيركم أنفاقكم للناس. Right? The best of you is the most beneficial of you to all of humanity. Maslaha is not just in the Sharia, it should be embodied in us. We should be people of benefit. That our lives should benefit society. Humanity should benefit from our existence. That was the dawah of the early Muslims. You know, the idea we have today of walking around, handing out pamphlets about Islam, having debates, all of this we learned from the Christians. That wasn't the dawah method of early Muslims. What did the early Muslims do? They loved Islam, and they benefited whichever community they moved to. And that was enough to make people fall in love with Islam. They didn't have to have public debates, they didn't hand person a pamphlet about what Islam says about this or that. Just being an embodiment of Islam was enough. And so, when we talk about benefits, are we people of benefits? Are we people who benefit others and avoid harming others? And so just as we must be beneficial to humanity, we must do everything we can to avoid harming ourselves and others. This is a principle we must live by. Do no harm. It should be a principle that we live by. One of the five main maxims of fiqh, la darar wa la dirar. Do not harm yourself or anyone. Do not cause any form of harm. Right? This is one of the five main maxims of fiqh. Do not cause any form of harm. This is a fundamental part of being a Muslim. Al Muslimu man salima Muslimu min lisanihi wa yadi. A Muslim is the one who other Muslims feel safe from his tongue and hand. Meaning what? You don't harm people. Right? So, we have to become people who are beneficial to humanity and we don't harm people. Right? Maslaha and mafsada is not just the Sharia, it's the people who follow the Sharia as well. Another benefit of knowing this is it's easier to stay away from sin when you understand the mafsada. It's easier to avoid a sin when you understand the harm it causes. Like for example, it's very easy for most Muslims to avoid alcohol. Why? By our fitrah, we understand the harms that come to alcohol. But other things we need someone to explain to us. Things like zina. We need someone to explain what are the mafsada of it. And when you explain to someone, you know, so for example, it's important to take your kids and show them the effects of drugs. To show them what smoking does to their lungs. To show them the actual harms. Because once someone sees it and it becomes a reality, they are far less likely to do it. Right? So when we teach our children about halal and haram, when we focus on the haram, we must focus on the mafsada. Why is it haram? What does it do to you? What will happen if you commit this sin? Likewise, there is more motivation to do good deeds when you are aware of the benefits, when you are working towards the goals. I mean, if someone is just praying salah because they have to pray salah, it's not the same as someone who's praying salah to increase the taqwa. It's two different things. If someone is fasting Ramadan because their whole family is fasting Ramadan, it's not the same as someone who's fasting Ramadan because they want to come out as a better Muslim. They have a goal. They're working towards something. Right? When you understand the benefits, because these aren't just benefits, these are maqasid. Maqasid means what? They are your goals. You have a goal. You pray salah, there's a goal. I'm praying salah because of this. I'm trying to achieve this. I'm fasting Ramadan so I can achieve that. There is a goal that you're working towards. Right? And finally, in our everyday decisions, whether in business, whether in family, whether it's with your neighbors, whatever it is, in everything, weigh every decision on a scale of mafsada and maslaha. And always make the decision which is most beneficial. So you will find in life, you will face many situations where every option, someone's getting hurt. You have to choose the one that is least harmful. You will have to choose sometimes between benefiting yourself and benefiting the ummah. Islam said in most of the cases, focus on what? Society. Sacrifice yourself for society. Right? The ummah comes first. And so if we understand these concepts, we can embody the sharia better. We can benefit others. We can prevent harm. We can stay away from sin more easily. We can do good deeds more easily. And we have a process for making decisions based on the sharia. So with that, we come to the end of today's presentation. And we open the floor to Q&A now. Next week, we begin discussing the dururiyat. So next week, we'll focus on the preservation of religion and life. What does the sharia actually say about that? And how does the sharia achieve these two goals? How does it protect life and how does it protect religion? And what are the exceptions to, and the maxims governing all of that? With that being said, any questions you have on anything covered today, you can ask now and we can discuss that for the remainder of today's session. Anyone have any questions? By the way, if someone wants to just write out a question to it, it's fine.
It's surprising that the madrasas don't have this
subject at all. At all.
I think it's something we take granted if you go out. But it's not a subject that you teach. I don't think this is something that people who write the curriculum
will even know exists.
Or school. If you take a school, how does the school discuss it? Let me tell you what's around. Let me tell you why.
Yeah.
I think this is so important. Maybe you should have done a brilliant job today talking about the Muslim and Muslim. I don't think we need to write this thing.
Yeah.
I think we should teach this thing as well. I think that's so important. The second one you raised, and that is already, I raised it last week as well, about sexification. Again, quite a nice way of making mention of the fact that parents are finding difficulty communicating this to their children. It's taboo to talk about sexuality in the families. Schools, I don't know how the schools are doing. It's coming now. CSE is coming. So that's going to be a major, major disruption in the curriculum or life orientation when we're discussing this. And from briefly what I heard about the CSE, it's quite...
Yeah, this whole issue we have in the Indian culture of not talking about this topic with our children, this doesn't come from the Indian culture. And this doesn't come from the Islamic culture. It actually comes from the British culture. When the British colonized the Muslim world, especially India, we learned the British prudish values, which they have abandoned, but we still held on to. If you go before that, to Islamic India, when Islam was Islamic, or even before that, the Hindu India, they were very open about these topics. And classical Muslims were very open about these topics. It was something that they would sit down and teach their children about and have very frank discussions with their children about. I mean, Umar radiallahu anhu told people, teach your daughter Surah Nur. Teach your daughter Surah Nur. What is Surah Nur? Don't commit zina, wear hijab, lower your gaze, who are your mahrams. All of this is Surah Nur. So you're going to have discussions about these topics with your daughters when teaching them Surah Nur. And Umar and he said, you must teach them Surah Nur when they're close to the age of puberty. You have to teach this to them. If we look at classical works, Tafsir al-Qurtubi, for example, there are passages in Tafsir al-Qurtubi. If I had to translate them, you all would blush. Just put it that way. The books are that explicit. They are that explicit. As-Suyuti is even more explicit. Right? Because their culture was different. This culture we have where we don't talk about this topic at all, this is actually something that's foreign to Islam. And this has been very harmful. For the past 100 years, we've been latching onto this culture. It has been very harmful. We are now probably in the third generation of Muslims who are committing zina. Now, let's be frank, there are people out there who committed zina, and now their children are committing zina. And their children are going to think about committing zina. Because it's becoming so normalized. And because no one talks about it. And I said, people tell me this. My parents never told me. You know, I dealt with another case where a boy hit puberty, and he only learned he hit puberty 2 years later because nobody spoke to him about that topic. 2 years later, he's learning Islamic studies with a teacher, and he's studying puberty, and then he's like, but this happened to me 2 years ago. I didn't know about it. I mean, we're not preparing them for life, right? If you're not going to talk about these things. And yes, it's awkward, but it has to be done. And if we don't do it, again, the government's going to do it. Netflix is going to do it. YouTube is going to do it. And you don't want them to learn from them, because they're not going to learn maslaha and mafsada. They're going to learn freedom, sexual revolution, enjoy your youth, experiment. You know, try being a girl for a day. That's the new thing now. I'm a boy today, I'm a girl tomorrow. Whatever I feel. Non-binary. They're going to experiment with these things unless you sit them down and you discuss it. Parents have to sit down their children and discuss these things with them. Allah created a man and a woman, and that's what you are. You're either a man or a woman. And He created them for each other, and this is how the human race survives. You have to sit down and discuss these things. If we don't, the zina in our community is going to get worse and worse and worse. It's going to get worse. The only people who can actually help children overcome these topics are their parents. Because if a parents have to have a different relationship with their children at that age, but they have to have someone they can talk to about the thoughts going through their mind, about what society is saying, about what's going on in TV, what their school friends are saying, you know, what everybody is doing. They need to be able to talk about these things. Otherwise, you know, it's just going to get worse.
For the start, I'm sure most of the people here, we grew up in schools where we sat next to girls, and if it was a non-Muslim girl you were sitting to, more likely than not, you didn't have a pants and very often a very short dress.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But we didn't grow up to be sexual perverts.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us grew up, if you didn't go to an there weren't that many Islamic schools.
Right? Yeah.
That's how we spent most of our school life. I'm sure many here. By the way, our Indian culture, of course, gave right to Kama Sutra, but it's not the Arabic culture. But we didn't grow up to be sexual perverts, and then, of course, we had guidance in school, so as definites, there was no life orientation, but we had guidance, you know, teachers spoke about whatever things. Then we have the phenomenon now, and I'm sure many of us know friends, family, who's even one, you know, a girl looks at a boy, talks to a boy, out, you want to an Islamic girls' school, or you go out of school and you're doing homeschooling. And obviously, there's a lot of Islamic schools are now boys and girls school to separate, or only girls school, only boys' school. There's a preponderance of Islamic literature available, all of that. And yet, we are seeing from conservative Muslim families the amount of not pregnancies, but certainly experimentation, things going wrong. It's just escalating. Worse than, and these are kids who grow up boys' school, girls' school, they're 15 and a half years. I'm trying to figure out
why.
What went wrong between us who sat next to girls with short dresses, and all our 10 years we sat next to a girl, and it was not an issue. But now we are so conscious.
Two things went wrong. First, the culture itself. The culture today is one where sex is everything. And even the ones in conservative homes have Netflix, they have YouTube, they have Pornhub, they have all these things. They have all these things, right? You get cases where people find a niqabi daughter is addicted to pornography. And that's the other thing. Besides the culture, it's pornography. When y'all were kids, there was no internet with free pornography. Right? Yeah, but it wasn't free online. There you could get caught. That you had to hide under the bed and sneak. Right? Now it's free, it's on this little brick that nobody will even know someone's watching it. Right? People are exposed to that before they're exposed to Islamic education. That thing is in their head. It's completely caught all their thoughts before anyone sat them down and spoke to them about things Islamically. The culture has completely, radically changed. You know, just to give you an example, when we were kids, I'm a generation younger than you, when we were kids, you know, the idea of nudity on TV was still something bad. It was still something bad. Right? Today, Everyone, even the practicing Muslims with big beards, are posting on Facebook about the latest episode of Game of Thrones. Full nudity there. But they're boasting about it. It's nothing wrong. You know, watch it, everyone watches. I'm not saying I watch it. I don't watch it. But I'm saying people, that's what they say. They say, I watch it, he watches it, everyone watches it. Right? They don't even see it as wrong to be looking at nudity on TV. They don't see it as wrong. And this is a scary point. Our generation may have sneakingly did haram things knowing it's haram. The current generation don't even think it's haram. They don't see the harm in looking at nudity. I mean, they've watched hardcore pornography. For them, the nudity on TV is... They don't consider it pornography. They consider it art. They consider it acting. They don't see the harm in it. So the culture is very, very different. This culture is so bad, it doesn't matter how conservative your home is. It doesn't matter how... you know, your education system is, it doesn't matter how your child dresses, they're going to be exposed to it. What matters is sitting them down at a young age and really talking them through it. And for them to be able to discuss, because again, because the culture has changed, the parenting has to change. Your generation, your parents didn't have to talk to you about this. You know, back then, the non-Muslims of our community too were much more religious. You guys went to school, what, before apartheid time? Or after that? Apartheid time, obviously. Right? 70s. Yeah, so that's way before apartheid time. I mean, this was a very religious country back then. Right? It wasn't this freedom that we have today. Our generation was the first generation post-apartheid to go to school. Things were still okay. But in those cultures, you could get away with not talking to your child about this. In the modern culture, we have to talk about it. And we have to talk about it from the perspective of benefit and harms, because their main idea is they don't see the harm in looking at nudity. They don't see the harm in watching Game of Thrones. They don't see the harm of looking at pornography. I have had young people tell me pornography keeps me away from zina. That's what they tell me. They tell me if I don't look at pornography, I'm going to end up sleeping with a woman. They don't see the harm in it. So who's talking to them about these things? You know, who's bringing up these topics? Who's actually... showing them what's the harm in, because pornography is a drug. It has the same effects on your brain as other drugs. No one talks about this. No one tells the kids about this. It's literally an addiction that will mess up their brain for life. So, the discussion has to be had. With the current generation, we can't sit back. That generation, yes, alhamdulillah, you all grew up in a better time. Even sitting next to a girl, you knew your morals, she knew her morals. You grew up in a good Muslim home, she grew up in a good Christian or Hindu home. Everybody had their morals. Right? Nowadays, the way the television works, I mean, you know, the other day I was looking at the shows for teenagers on Netflix. Not the shows for adults, the shows for teenagers. They're literally all about sex, nothing else. Just about teenagers having sex. You know, they have more sex than the shows for adults. So, teenagers watching that, and you think someone's a niqabi going to an all-girls school and becoming a alima, she's not exposed to that? She has Netflix on her phone. Probably sharing a friend's account if her parents don't have a Netflix account. They're exposed to all these things, right? So the discussion has to be had. It's a completely different culture. Any other questions or comments? Professor?
I think one of the problems speaking with young teachers is that the parents have outsourced behavior in the schools.
Yeah, that's a big one.
I think the father is mother's son. So the parents are in particular, so basic, maybe just the father.
Yeah.
The ustad, the upper, or morana, or whoever, had to teach the basic thing. We were basically how to make wuzu, or so, etc. That was it, right? Nothing else. And now the Islamic schools, the assumption is that the Islamic teacher is going to teach them not only knowledge, but also behavior. But that only comes from the home. That's right. There is this huge, I think it's responsibility.
Probably in many cases,
both parents are working. They don't have time. So they're assuming that the school will do the job, and then suddenly they realize the things have gone poorly because they were not there to monitor.
Yeah.
What they did. I think we have this huge problem where responsibility is
No, you hit the nail on the head. That's really the big problem in our community, is that parenting nowadays simply means providing food, school fees, toys, games, money, holidays. but not education and tarbiyah. All of that's outsourced to the schools. And they expect the schools to do everything, but human beings growing up need their parents emotionally. They need their parents to talk to, they need their parents to answer questions that they might be unable to ask at school. Or the school might even give them a wrong answer. Right? And children have to have, the relationship parents have with their children has to be evolving to deal with these issues. So I don't know how to solve this. I honestly don't. I sit and think about it. How do we change the mentality that it's the school's job to educate my child? Because that's a mentality that's been in our community for multiple generations now. How do you change that? I don't know. I honestly don't know. It's something we'll have to brainstorm and figure out together. But it is one of the main causes of this problem. Parents don't see it as their duty to talk to their children. They don't see it as their duty to advise their children. They don't even see it as their duty to be their role model to their children. Everything's the school's job and the molana's job. And once the child's 15, 16 years old, and they fall into a major sin, take it to a molana to fix it. Right? Parents don't want to actually play the role of a parent. And in classical Islamic world, the children's main teacher were their mother and father. Their mother, because we know staying at home moms is more common, and the main job of a stay at home mom is the tarbiyah of her children. But the fathers played a very big role as well. I mean, when you hear the Sahaba and stuff and how they speak about their fathers, there's always that, those educational moments where they going out together. And, you know, for in the ancient days, fathers would teach their sons how to be a man, how to provide for a family, how to treat a woman. You know, they would take their son out and talk to them about these topics. This culture is gone. The culture is gone. Fathers these days want nothing to do with raising the children. So I don't know how to change it. Allah knows best. I really have no clue how to change it. Any other questions or comments?
I think that's good. In future, anyone who wants to get married must undergo the course.
I love that idea. A lot of people have brought up that idea.
Could you tell how, the responsibility? Lots of couples have absolutely no idea what responsibilities are in marriage. Mm-hmm. They get married, and then suddenly, the question all kinds of they don't know how to deal with it.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons why you have such high divorce rate. So, in the Catholic Church, you have to go through that program. Unless, you've completed that and received a certificate as a premarital counselor, mm-hmm. you can't get married. So, I know it's because, people would say it's not a legal thing. It's not a legal thing.
Yeah. But it's a matter of maslaha. Yeah.
But maybe you should use the argument of the harm of
sin. Yeah.
No. I mean, there's no doubt about it that divorce rate is highest ever.
And if this can bring it down even 10%, it makes a big difference.
Just give you the job. write a document about this and pitch it to the ulama and say, we don't do a marriage, we don't do a nikah, we don't settle on that unless a child, a boy and a girl, go. Seriously, what you're saying is absolutely correct. There's been so many attempts to run marriage counseling. Look at the attempts. Right? This can be something that is given up. Okay, because the response has been poor. But yet, look at this idea of Muslim and Muslim. And write a document. Maybe it's an idea that we should explore.
And I think one of the problems again is, some of them want to run a cause, but then they want separate people for their separate people. How does it work? You could get them together. Talk to each other. I mean, it's just crazy. We are going to get married eventually.
Yeah.
So they need to be related to each other, to talk to each other, to share their ideas.
See if they're compatible.
No, it doesn't work this way. I mean, you speak to two different people, but actually have no idea what the other one is saying.
Yes. Okay. There's two things that I need to change. One, our education system. I really believe marriage, the rights of the husband and wife, how to be a good husband and wife, needs to be taught in high school. It needs to be taught in high school, Islamic high school. That's where I believe it needs to be taught. Right? Because either after high school they're getting married or after university they're getting married. Either way, it needs to be taught at that level. The other thing that needs to change over there is our ultra-conservative culture of how you interact with the opposite gender. Right, because we have two extremes in Durban. We've got everything goes, and we've got not even allowed to look at the eyes. Right, we've got these two extremes. and to find a balanced middle part where, you know, you can find a way to make things work in the middle part. Again, there's way too many issues to even bring up here to discuss. But, you know, just the idea of a halal date, where a girl and guy go out to a public place, her father comes with, or maybe her brother comes with, sits at a separate table, they're in public, they're not touching, the brother's right there to see, and they have a discussion face to face and share ideas about what they will expect from a marriage. I think just that idea alone probably will get me lynched in this community. They'll find me hanging on.
Except for the upper middle class and the wealthy, the debt levels are low. But generally, many of our community now are in debt.
Yes, they are.
And to just buy a car or a home, it's becoming very, very difficult.
Yep.
If we look at the, obviously there is this attempt with a lot of Islamic finance, it's very positive, very good. But if you look at it currently, the extent of security that you need, it's almost impossible for anyone at the lower ranks to actually make it to the next level.
There's another point related to that's important to me. Again, I'm very critical about education system. One area our education system has failed is financial management, financial intelligence. We don't teach people how to budget. We don't teach people how to save. We don't teach people how to invest. We don't teach people how to grow their money. We don't teach people how to live on what you have. Instead, we are bombarded 24 hours by adverts: buy this on credit, buy this on loan, buy this pay over 12 months, buy this pay over 2 years. But no one's teaching them how to say no to that, how to live your life on a budget, how to stick to what you are earning. This is one of the things I taught my kids through homeschooling. I did a whole 2-year curriculum with them on financial intelligence, financial management, rich dad, poor dad, all those things I taught it to them. Right? And these kind of things need to be taught in school. Right? These things have to be taught in school because, you know, my generation, I don't know if you guys know this, my generation, nobody saves money. My generation don't have savings. The average person my age has zero savings. They don't know what is saving. They don't have retirement savings. They don't even think about a concept called retirement. For them, the idea of retirement is something they don't think about yet. They have no such thing as a retirement saving. Why? They grew up with zero financial education and financial intelligence. So what's going to happen when my generation gets old? We finished.
The baby bastards, you are not the baby bastards.
But having said that, even with education...
Education is a big step up. It makes a big difference.
Right place.
You're right. Firstly, the riba system combined with capitalism, combined with the bribery and corruption and everything in this country, with the escalating prices of living. I mean, rent alone is like 20 grand in most places now. It's impossible. But financial education will make some difference. The other difference is the overall of the system, and that's something that's not in our control. I mean, how do we overhaul the system?
You see, when I was looking at the documentary about Yunus Mohammed from Bangladesh,
yes, the bank he started.
He started a system of banking.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it's still linked to riba. But
yeah,
the success rate of how he's brought people up and got people into...
Yeah, I know his story. Yeah,
is by peer pressure.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if you don't pay your loan, the community around you is going to be very upset with you.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow, our current Islamic financial institutions, the way I look at it, is that it services a certain level class.
It's designed for the upper middle class. It's not designed for everybody
but
else.
If you look at what's going to happen from now and what I see foresee in the next maybe 8 to 10 years, people's lives are going to become miserable because to buy a car, now education is going to become more expensive because public schooling is not. Your hospital systems are not working. And I can just see the kind of debt levels that you can get into. And I think we need to solve this issue even with the current
systemic
finance kind of houses that are around. We need to relook at this whole model.
Just even middle class families, most families are having challenges in looking at education.
Yeah,
I suppose
it was. Yeah, becoming a
We don't.
It's a good session, I think. I'm sure you all enjoying the session.